From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, what do Jim Carrey, Benicio del Toro, and Batwoman have in common? They all have TV projects in the works. Then legendary songwriter Randy Newman talks about his career and why he wrote a song about Vladimir Putin.
It was this shirt-off stuff. I just didn't understand. It's like he wanted to not only be absolute ruler, but he wanted to be Tom Cruise, you know, like a matinee idol.
And a transgender activist explains how telling positive transgender stories will be better for Hollywood and the country. All that coming right up. The Television Critics Association's summer press tour has just concluded. It's the twice-a-year gathering when TV networks, cable channels, and streaming services talk up their best new shows to a room full of critics and reporters. This year, just a couple of days into the press tour, The New Yorker published a lengthy story detailing multiple allegations of sexual misconduct against CBS head Les Moonves. The article raised questions of how CBS executives would or would not respond to inquiries about CBS's culture during its presentation this past Sunday. Here's Daniel Feinberg, a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter and president of the TCA.
What they actually said was reasonably minimal, I think. Kelly Call, the network entertainment president, got out there and he made an initial statement. The basic message of that statement was there's very little I can say. There are independent investigations going on, et cetera, et cetera. We want to make sure that the voices of the accusers have their opportunity to be heard, et cetera. And then basically he fielded, you know, he fielded 25 to 30 minutes of questions, some of them a little bit evasively about whether or not the culture at CBS needed a complete overhaul. So his opinion, not shockingly, was that the overall culture of the company does not, in fact, need to be scrapped and rebuilt from scratch. Mostly sort of as TCA president, I was grateful that Kelly Call got up there, talked to the reporters, attempted to answer questions, and that there was a civil exchange of ideas, which is all that press tour ideally should ever be.
Yeah, one thing he did say, which a lot of people find appalling, is that the women he knows didn't say they were harassed or assaulted by Les Moonves, which I think is an incredibly lame defense. And a lot of people have given it, but I guess that's, you know, that was his story and he was sticking with it. How did the network go about switching gears and talking about their upcoming programming? Something like, let's talk about Murphy Brown now. Did that happen?
It did happen. And Diane English began with a very brief statement about how the show intended to do a Me Too episode. And I believe it's going to be called Murphy Too. You can see what they did there. And then they moved right into discussing the show and talking about how everyone was happy to come back and how everyone loved this opportunity and how Murphy Brown was more relevant than ever before. And there actually were no follow-up questions about exactly how dogged the show, which has had in the past no problems whatsoever addressing real-life situations and real-life perpetrators of bad acts, would address the fact that they're on a network under this cloud. But it was at least vaguely touched on. And then the next day when the CW and Showtime went, Mark Pedowitz was not asked about it at all. I guess people figure that the CW is so far down the corporate ladder that it's not an issue. And then David Nevins of Showtime gave an initial statement and then was not asked any follow-up questions about it, perhaps for same reasons.
And what about Showtime, the CW? What news did they have about what's coming up for them in the fall?
Showtime has a couple big ticket items. They have the Jim Carrey series Kidding, which is probably going to be a good deal more odd and trippy and off-putting than fans of Jim Carrey's vintage comedies will be hoping for, but may in fact be exactly what fans of Jim Carrey's collaboration with Michel Gondry on Eternal Sunshine are hoping for. He was very quiet. He was very restrained, talking about his return to scripted television. They also have the star-studded prison drama Escape at Dannemora, which is directed by Ben Stiller and stars Benicio del Toro. So Showtime's keeping busy, as they do. And the CW, they keep talking about superhero shows. They couldn't even announce the Batgirl casting, which broke literally one day later. That was a minor disappointment for us. Rather, Batwoman, sorry, need to clarify. But the CW has, they've got a remake of Charmed, and everyone was excited to talk about how the racial identities of the characters would play into the overall series, as opposed to the day before when CBS's Magnum PI team kind of shrugged and said that they weren't going to pretend that Jay Hernandez wasn't Latino, but they weren't going to make the fact that the new Magnum PI is Latino into a big plot line. So yeah, everyone just selling their things and sometimes getting somewhat awkward questions and mostly just staying on message, I would say.
Let me ask you about ABC. What did they say about The Conners, which is the series with Roseanne without Roseanne that follows her firing?
Formally, they said absolutely nothing. ABC had a business profit call of some sort in the morning and used that as an excuse for Channing Dungey to not do an executive session with the assembled TCA reporters. Channing was available in the back of the room to talk to some people, and she did do an interview with my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, which I'm sure was great, and she was at the party in the evening talking to some people, but there was no actual getting on stage and talking about the timeline of how events went down with Roseanne, how events went down with ordering the Conners.
Disney and Fox are about to close their $71 billion merger. Is there any sense of how that will affect ABC, Fox Television, the production company, not the network, and Disney and Fox's cable channels, and about how they're all going to be integrated?
So far, everyone is speaking only in hypotheticals on that. And again, because Channing Dungey didn't do a press conference, that was not able to be addressed with her. The team at current Fox, Gary Newman and Dana Walden, they talked about how the network, how new Fox was going to have all of the advantages of being a quote-unquote independent network without a attached studio arm. And that was the thing they wanted to talk about. But I don't think we know yet, for example, what the circumstances are going to be with FX come press tour next winter. Is FX going to be already under the ABC, Disney, etc. umbrella? Probably not, but they could be. So it will be very interesting to see. This continues to be basically the biggest story in the biz at this moment. And so far, I don't think anyone really knows anything.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. He is also the president of the Television Critics Association. Daniel, thanks so much for coming back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, singer and songwriter Randy Newman revisits his considerable songbook. He also gets me to cry a little bit. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. 50 years ago, Randy Newman sat down at the piano, played a New Orleans shuffle, and sang Davy the Fat Boy, Isn't He Round?
What do we weigh, folks? Can you guess what he weighs?
At the time, people found his satirical, often morbid lyrics, well, offensive. He was more established as a songwriter for other artists, especially after Judy Collins made a hit out of his song, I Think It's Gonna Rain Today. But by 1977, his gravelly voice and sharp wit had found an audience with his first major hit, Short People. He went on to achieve even greater fame for his film scores for Ragtime and Toy Story. At the Hollywood Bowl this coming Sunday, Newman will perform music from his 50 years as a songwriter, from his first album to his most recent, Dark Matter, a crazy musical take on the country's political divides. When I spoke with Newman, I asked him how, given his huge catalog of songs, he decides which ones to play.
You know, irrespective of how well-known the songs are, I do what I think an audience is going to like. You know, I know I'm going to do something like Think It's Gonna Rain, which is popular with people. You know, You Got a Friend, and there are things that people have liked through the years that I'll play. Of course, it's what I'm comfortable doing as well. But I've always thought at the shows for them, you know, I hear artists say that I do what I want to do, and that's what I do. But I'm not so sure that many artists do that. It's inherently a conservative medium. If you do something, if you say something that works, you'll say it again. You play something and it works very well, you'll do it again. When I write, I try and grow to some extent, you know, to like go different places and do different things. But performing, if something works, there's a really irresistible tendency to leave it in.
You will be conducted by your cousin, David Newman, at the Hollywood Bowl, and you'll be playing with an orchestra. How do you figure out what the arrangements are, what the charts are? Because a lot of these songs you might have just performed on piano. Now you're going to have brass, you're going to have woodwinds.
Yeah.
How does that all come together in terms of the way the songs are going to sound in this new setting?
The ones that have orchestra on the records are the ones that I'll do. You know, Think It's Gonna Rain as strings, for instance. You Got a Friend's got a sort of a little band on it. So it's whatever I did at the time. I did the arrangements. So if I did a song just on piano, I'm going to do it just on piano.
I want to play part of a song from your most recent album. The album's called Dark Matter. This song is called Putin.
Putin putting his pants on one leg at a time. Me, he's just like a regular fella. He ain't nothing like a regular fella. Putin putting his hat on, hat size number 9. You saying Putin's getting big-headed? Putin's hair's just fine. He can drive.
We should say lyrics by Randy Newman, asterisk with assistance from Donald Trump. I mean, this song is almost about the idolatry of a dictator. How did this song come about? Do you think of one thing first, lyrics, tone?
The idea came first with this one. Sometimes it's I just stumble in playing something on the piano and it engenders something that I'll say. But this one, I wanted to write a song about Putin because it was before Trump.
Yeah.
It was this shirt off stuff. I just didn't understand. It's like he wanted to not only be absolute ruler, but he wanted to be Tom Cruise, you know, like a matinee idol. It's an odd thing.
I want to talk about another song on this album. It's called The Great Debate, and it unfolds almost like a stage drama. We're going to listen to a little bit of it. A scientist is just unsuccessfully tried to explain to the moderator what dark matter is.
Yeah.
Of course not.
Let me get this straight. You don't know what it is. You don't know where it is. We can't get any. Put that to the one side. Let's put the Lord, faith, eternity, whatever, on the other side. Show of hands.
This is really a song about whether or not we can actually solve problems through smart dialogue and the exchange of informed information. It almost feels like this is a song that is perfect for the moment that we're living in. Do you think that it is thematically part of what this whole album is trying to get to?
Yeah. I think that's the best thing I ever did, this one.
Ever?
Yes.
Wow.
I think so. It's a debate between faith and science. And the moderator is clearly dismissive of the scientific side of it, but much like our leader now. The thing about it is that faith has got all the fun stuff. You know, they've got phenomenal music from Bach on. They've got, you know, art, everything. And science has the facts tiresomely tugging on your coat, telling you what really is. And that's what the song's about for me.
A lot of people... keep going. Go ahead.
All I was going to say was, I wish I could explain it a little better, but that's all right.
A lot of people, especially parents of young kids, probably encountered a lot of your music by watching Pixar animated films. I'm going to talk about a song that you wrote for Toy Story 2 back in 1999. I have to say, it's one of my favorite songs of yours, and I'm going to try not to cry as we listen to a little bit of it.
Me too. Me too.
When somebody loved me, everything was beautiful. Every hour we spent together lives within my heart. And when she was sad, I was there to dry her tears.
I didn't make it through it without crying.
Oh.
This is a beautiful song. It's performed by Sarah McLachlan. I'm going to ask you, first of all, at what point in the process of the film do you hear, we need a song here, here's the scene, Is there a rough storyboard? Have they put together a reel?
Yeah, it's just a storyboard. And they'll say, this is what we want to express, more or less, that this girl, the toy, the cowboy, Jessie, has lost her life's companion, and it hurts. And so I wrote it, and I thought that kids wouldn't sit still for it. And I said, you sure you want to do this? And they said, yeah. And they did it, and I went to a preview, and this is like 5 to 10-year-olds, and they sat there, not a sound, you know?
Many times in your songwriting career, you have gone to some dark places with some dark characters. I'm thinking of the carnival con man and Davy the Fat Boy. What happens when people respond thinking that you are that person?
That was a problem for me. It's always been my mode of writing to do that kind of third-person thing. And it's not the norm for songwriters or for popular music. I was more misunderstood in the past. It's now people sort of get what I'm doing. I think a lot of things have improved because of The Simpsons, maybe.
You better have 9 lives because we have 8 knives. Yes, you've got an enemy. Hit your gut.
The irony is understood a little better than it was 50 years ago.
I'm wondering if you ever have found that some of your songs have been used by other people to convey a totally opposite meaning than that which you originally intended.
Yeah. I have a song called Sail Away, which is about a recruiter for the slave trade. And he is saying, come to America, it'll be great. But I've heard records, a couple of them, where the artists made it sort of celebratory.
When you do a lot of work in animation, Toy Story, Princess and the Frog, Cars, it's a good gig. I suspect they pay you well for it. Does it start to affect the way that other people see you as an artist? Can you get typecast by doing that, even if you do it well?
You do get typecast. I mean, I'd like to have done more pictures like The Natural or Ragtime, but I didn't get the offers, really. I got more of the animation, which is hard. There's more movement. If someone falls, you go ba-dum ba-dum. And, you know, if Tom Hanks in a live-action thing falls, you don't go ba-dum ba-dum. It has everything in it, anime, at least what the guys and the women at Pixar do. And their emotions have to be treated as if they were adults. But yeah, there's that. And there's also just doing movies at all. People say that I've sold out in some kind of way. But I grew up with movie music as a sort of exalted art form. That's how my family felt about it. It's how I feel about it. And to me, it's just as serious an endeavor as writing songs. I'm sure when I kick off, if I'm known at all, it'll be as a songwriter. But to me, the pictures are equally important. Sometimes that gets mitigated, or a better word you can think of and plug it in there, by the fact that you're not free to do what you want or think you should do. It's a director's medium. If a director tells you to use a kazoo and a washboard to do a love scene, you have to do it. You know, there's nothing you can do.
Randy Newman, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. I tried my hardest.
Yeah, I think you succeeded.
Thank you.
Up next on The Frame, a new campaign is underway to get Hollywood to tell more and more accurate stories about trans people.
Sun stopped shining. It rained all the time. Did set me back some, but I made it through. But I'll never get over losing you.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. GLAAD is one of Hollywood's most important advocacy organizations. GLAAD has worked with film and TV executives to ensure that depictions of LGBT characters do not fall into hurtful stereotypes. GLAAD is now working to improve how transgender characters are depicted and cast. As part of the town's Me Too and Time's Up movements, the organization recently issued a letter to the industry offering its resources so that Hollywood can, quote, use its powers to improve the lives of trans people by changing America's understanding of who trans people are. Nick Adams is GLAAD's Director of Transgender Media and Representation. When he visited the frame, I started by asking him about the origins of GLAAD.
They used to stand for the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, and several years ago, we dropped that as an acronym because, A, we didn't talk about bisexual and transgender people in the acronym, and also, you know, we were no longer so much about defamation. I think when we started in the 80s, a lot of those activists who started GLAAD, they were mostly responding to defamation of a variety of kinds, not only of the news coverage of the AIDS crisis, but Vito Russo, one of GLAAD's founders, also wrote The Celluloid Closet and was very much about how Hollywood had defamed basically gay and lesbian and bisexual people for so many years. And GLAAD's job, hopefully my job, is to work with content creators to say, let's put those in the past, move beyond them, and create more authentic, well-rounded, multidimensional portrayals of transgender people.
No, I'm thinking of Buffalo Bill and Silence of the Lambs, a horrific example of what a trans character looked like in an Oscar-winning film.
Yes, unfortunately, there's many of those. And I'm working with a filmmaker now who's making a documentary that is going to be hopefully sort of the transgender version of The Celluloid Closet, looking back at like Dressed to Kill and Michael Caine and Silence of the Lambs and Ace Ventura and some of these really horribly transphobic portrayals of transgender people that Hollywood has put out. And there were those that were very clearly transphobic. And then there have been others where the effort was to create a more empathetic character, one that was meant to evoke maybe viewer sympathy rather than repulsion. And yet, even those portrayals have still not really fully created these multidimensional trans characters. And then the casting of those characters would also undercut whatever positive message was in the script. So when they would routinely cast from John Lithgow to Terrence Stamp to Philip Seymour Hoffman, they would cast these cisgender men to play transgender women, sending the message that transgender women are really just men in dresses.
Right. I'm thinking of some recent series and movies, Tangerine, Pose, Transparent, Saturday Church, that I think have done a really good job. So in terms of progress, what makes you feel like some people are starting to get it right? And where do you see some optimism in terms of shows that are being created?
So I think television particularly is starting to really get it right. I work with a lot of TV shows and networks who come to me, and when I say, they say they're creating a transgender character, and I say, have you considered casting a transgender actor? They're like, oh yes, we wouldn't do it any other way, which is very exciting. And right now, at this moment, as we speak today, there are 16 transgender characters on television, and all but two of them are played by transgender actors. So those shows that you mentioned, Pose particularly, I think, not only because of the actors that they cast, but also because they had Janet Mock and Our Lady J in the writer's room, because they had Silas Howard directing and co-executive producing. There were really transgender people kind of surrounding the entire production and bringing some real authenticity to the storytelling, as well as the portrayals by the actors. So that's very, very exciting. I think film is a very different industry. And we, aside from Tangerine and Saturday Church, which I think are really good, very low budget films that were cast authentically and told an interesting story about the trans experience, you know, we're not seeing that kind of progress yet at the films that come in with larger budgets.
As part of the Time's Up and Me Too movement, there's an initiative called 50-50 by 2020. How can GLAAD partner with that movement and that initiative to make sure that things that are important to you are part of the work that's being done?
We were really, really excited over this past month to work with 50-50 by 2020 to create this open letter to Hollywood that appeared in Variety, as well as a new resource guide called Transform Hollywood. And if you think about it, the open letter is sort of the why it's important to include transgender voices in the storytelling process from the very beginning and tell better stories about who trans people are. And the resource guide, Transform Hollywood, is like the how. between the two organizations, GLAAD and 50/50, we got 45 agencies, companies, and organizations to sign on to this open letter yesterday that appeared in Variety. And it's a really broad cross-section of the Hollywood industry with all the major agencies signing on, major production companies like Bad Robot and Apatow Productions and Shondaland, Time's Up signed on. So I really hope that this open letter and the groundswell of support from the community marks a sea change where Hollywood is going to start listening to trans voices and making a more inclusive storytelling process.
You are trying to encourage people to change, but at a certain point, how do you make sure that they are actually making progress? And what is your philosophy about scolding and shaming versus encouraging and educating?
Well, you know, for many years, some of these flat or uninteresting or not very accurate portrayals of transgender people got a lot of kudos in Hollywood and received a lot of nominations and awards for that, largely given by other non-transgender people who thought it was a good portrayal, even though transgender people were putting their hand up and saying, not really. I think that that's really changed in recent years. I think the box office receipts and the social media feedback to these inaccurate transgender portrayals coming from not just transgender people, but our family and our friends and our coworkers who know us, it's sending its own message to Hollywood. And I think that we want to say to Hollywood, not only is the right thing to do to make these better trans stories, it's going to be a better business model for you as well, because audiences are tired of seeing the psychopathic killer and the victim and the sex worker cliche. There are so many stories in the transgender community that have never been told. Like, it is an untapped goldmine for Hollywood who wants to tell transgender stories. They haven't even begun to tap the real stories yet, and audiences want those.
Nick Adams is GLAAD's Director of Transgender Media and Representation. Nick, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
And that will do it for today. I'm John Horn. We'll be back here tomorrow.